funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What stories can be told by a strand of human DNA, and what mysteries remain locked within it until they are switched on by our interactions with the environment? Genetic science today is such a towering component of our understanding of biology that it is hard to imagine a time before scholars had begun to understand the inherent codes that help control the development of living things. Author Sam Keen tells the story of the evolution of that understanding and explains what we still don't know for sure in his new book, The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. Sam, welcome back to Think.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You write here that we are both fascinated by the potential of DNA to explain who and what we are, and we're resistant to the idea of being reduced to only that. And it seems that ambivalence is probably appropriate.
Yeah, it's just sort of this double fascination in that we look to DNA to explain who we are and where our species came from, and even for clues about what's going to happen to us in the future, whether we're susceptible to diseases or things like that. But at the same time, when you start talking about being susceptible to diseases, it really does make a lot of people nervous. And, you know, that's pretty understandable, that feeling that trawling through your DNA is going to reveal a dark secret about you that maybe you don't want to face.
And in terms of DNA being a blueprint for what will happen to any living organism, talk a little bit about the interaction with environment. Because, for example, if you have a blueprint to build a little wooden shack, you can build it according to the same plans and put one in a really wet tropical climate and put one in a desert climate. And the desert one might be susceptible to termites or something, and the tropical one is susceptible to something else. A lot has to do with how and where we live.
Yeah, that's actually a very good analogy. Putting the same blueprint or the same product of that blueprint in different environments could have completely different results. Scientists are finding more and more behavioral traits and psychological traits that they know have some sort of genetic influence. But it turns out it is just that. It is just an influence. Those genes don't kind of rigidly determine anything about us, or at least very little about us. And so it kind of opens up the door for things like the environment coming in and interacting with our genes to make us who we are. So you really can't talk about one of them without the other one of them.
Can you talk for a moment about the difference between genes and DNA? Because it's so common to use the terms interchangeably when, in fact, they're not exactly the same thing.
Yeah, that is something that you need to sort of keep in mind, that they are a little bit distinct. DNA is really a chemical. It's a thing. You can get it stuck to your fingers. And it's really sort of the physical manifestation of that blueprint for building the things inside you. Genes are actually a little more abstract. You can talk about genes, in fact, without having any knowledge of what they're made of. And scientists for a long time did talk about things like genes without having any idea that DNA was involved. There was, you know, half a century of work before people realized that DNA was part of what was going on. So I like to think about genes as like a story, the story of a human being or the story of humankind. And DNA is like the language that story is written in. So they're obviously closely related, but they are distinct things.
So let's talk about how scientists figured all of this out. There's this Swiss doctor, Friedrich Miescher, and he discovers DNA. How did that happen?
Well, he was working actually in the old kitchen of an enormous castle somewhere in Germany. He was a very young researcher, and he wanted to study white blood cells. Actually, he was assigned the task of studying white blood cells, and so he had to go to a local hospital every day, and they would actually bring him these kind of pus-filled bandages, and he had to wash all of the white blood cells out of them day after day after day. It was really sort of awful work that he had to immerse himself in. But from that, he was able to find this substance called he eventually called DNA. He called it nuclein, but it became known to DNA as DNA to us. And he didn't really know what it was. He thought it was maybe a protein at first, so he tried all these tests. He tried to dye it certain colors. He tried to dissolve it in hydrochloric acid, do all these different things to it. But it just didn't behave like a protein would. So he realized he discovered something different. And even though he did discover DNA, scientists really didn't know what DNA did at the time. And in fact, a lot of them thought that DNA was kind of an unimportant molecule. Maybe it stored a little phosphorus for our cells or something like that, but no one really linked it to inheritance for a very long time. And Miescher, in fact, died kind of obscure and unknown, and no one really appreciated the work that he'd done. A lot of people know the story of Gregor Mendel, who was the one who discovered genes, the monk who discovered genes working with pea plants. And it's sort of eerie that the same thing happened with both the man who discovered genes, Mendel, and the man who discovered DNA, Miescher. They both died completely obscure. They didn't know about each other, and no one really realized that they'd done this really fundamental work, actually just a few years apart from each other in the 1800s. So linking those things to inheritance really took a long time.
And remind everybody, I think everyone studied Gregor Mendel at least in high school, but remind everybody of why his discoveries were so groundbreaking, even though they were not really appreciated in his day. Because before he came along, people had assumed that heredity was sort of a blend of different traits, is that it?
Yeah, there was actually a whole host of theories, some sort of scientific but not exactly correct. Some were just these hoary old wives' tales, basically, all sorts of really elaborate tales about how traits got passed on. What Mendel did is he came in and he studied pea plants again. And what was really important were a couple things. One, he studied isolated traits. So he would look at whether a pea plant was tall or short, or if it had green peas or wrinkled peas. So he was looking at one trait in isolation, and that was really one of the keys. People like Charles Darwin actually studied pea plants themselves and tried to figure out inheritance, general laws of inheritance through pea plants. But Darwin was trying to look at all of these different traits at once, you know, 10 or 12 different traits, and he kind of got overwhelmed at the complexity of it. Mendel was smart enough to break it down to one trait at a time, and because of that, he was able to succeed where people like Darwin, frankly, had failed. The other thing Mendel did was he discovered what are known as dominant and recessive traits. So tall was a dominant trait, and if you have one gene for tallness and one gene for shortness, the tall gene will dominate. It will win out over the short gene. However, sometimes two tall parents can actually have a short child if the child inherits both of these short genes. So he showed how traits can kind of get smuggled along between generations without getting diluted. And that's a really, really important idea in genetics, that these traits can be out there, but they might not be expressed until they get mixed in with other genes in a new child.
So by the late 19th century, you have work that has been done by Darwin, you have work that has been done by Mendel, and scientists are still trying to figure out the way all of this plays out together. Talk about the botanist Hugo de Vries and what conclusions he reached and what he got wrong.
Hugo de Vries, this is actually a time when Darwinism was in decline, and I don't think a lot of people know this today, but right around 1900, a lot of scientists really disliked Darwinism, and they thought that evolution happened. They gave Darwin credit for proving evolution happened, but they didn't like his idea about natural selection, because Darwin always emphasized that natural selection and evolution happened very slowly, kind of achingly slowly, generation after generation, these very minute changes. A lot of scientists, including de Vries, thought that evolution happened much faster. They wanted to talk about jumps in evolution. And de Vries' theory was that creatures underwent these mutation periods, he called them, where for some reason, he didn't know exactly why, but for some reason there might be children who were much different from their parents. They might have, he was a botanist, so he might be they might have, you know, different flowers, or they might suddenly be taller or suddenly drought resistant or something like that. So he was one of those people who was into big changes between generations. And a lot of people thought that seemed like a more promising general theory for biology than Darwinism. And for a while, it looked, in fact, like Darwinism, might be sort of relegated to a historical obscurity, hard as it is to believe.
But then you have Thomas Hunt Morgan come along, and one of the most brilliant things he did was figuring out what kind of organism to study in order to get a lot of research done.
Yeah, he was really the first fruit fly geneticist. They're kind of the workhorse of genetics and have been ever since Morgan got involved. And Morgan is kind of an unlikely hero in science history in that he was coming in at a time when, again, a lot of people didn't like Darwinism. And there were also a lot of people promoting Mendelism, promoting genetics in its place. Morgan actually came in and he didn't like Charles Darwin or Gregor Mendel. He thought they were both kind of bunk. He thought they were just these big, bloviating, speculative theories without a lot of evidence for them. And he actually set out to disprove both Darwinism and Mendelism. In the end, he ended up proving both of them correct, more spectacularly than he ever could have hoped, thanks to the fruit fly. The fruit fly is really a good organism to work with in genetics, because you get a lot of creatures each generation, so you have a lot of chances for mutations to arise. And fruit flies also reproduce very quickly, every 12 or 13 days or so. So you get a lot of new generations. Morgan actually started working with pigeons and other animals, but they just grew too slowly. And he really didn't make his breakthroughs until he started working with fruit flies. And it's kind of incredible that all of this great work came out of Morgan's lab, because, as I explained in the book, it was really kind of a disgusting place. They had, rotten fruit sitting around. There were mice crawling through. It was a very small room as well, only 16 feet by 23 feet, and there were 8 desks in there for people, thousands of bottles lying around with all this filth in them. So it's really incredible that a place like this could produce such great science, but really, that's where genetics got started, was in Thomas Hunt Morgan's laboratory.
And it was Morgan who concluded that genes were located in chromosomes?
Yeah, it was Morgan, and he really had some brilliant, brilliant assistants working for him well. They don't often get as much credit historically, but Morgan's team was the one who figured out that genes actually reside on chromosomes, and that each chromosome inside us actually has multiple genes on it. This was something that scientists were debating about at the time, and a lot of scientists didn't believe it. They thought that chromosomes did something else. They thought that genes came into a creature from its parents in a different way. But Morgan was the one who figured out, no, it's chromosomes that actually carry the genetic information between generations. So that was one of his big things that he did.
My guest is science writer Sam Keen. His new book is called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. You can join this conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Thank Gone, KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Sam Keen. His new book is called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. You can join us this afternoon by calling 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. So, Sam, we can't go too much further with this story without talking about mutations and why they happen occasionally.
Yeah, mutations are really changes in your DNA. Either a gene will get damaged or, it will get changed somehow. And what ends up happening is that a body trait somehow gets changed as a result of that. So that's the basic idea behind a mutation, is a change in DNA that produces a change in body traits usually.
And they can be good or bad depending on what they cause in terms of function.
Yeah, the general theory is that most mutations are bad. They are not good for you. But every once in a while, a mutation arises that is, in fact, good for you, that kind of gives you a boost. It might make you healthier or faster. It might make your brain a little bit bigger, something like that. Or if the environment changes, if a drought comes or something like that, a gene that was kind of neutral in the first environment might end up being beneficial or bad in the new environment. So again, it's the environment and genes working together, and then mutations are ultimately what drive all of the genetic diversity and the diversity of life around us.
Let's talk about that diversity of life, because one of the things that's really fascinating in this book is the idea that DNA can really tell us a lot about the history of life on Earth. As far as we know, there was no life on Earth when the planet was initially formed. Then there were these single-celled organisms, and now we have such an array of complex life forms. Talk a little bit about how we went from single cells to what we are today and what all of the other species and organisms on Earth are.
Yeah, if you look at the history of life on Earth, of course, when the planet was kind of molten, melted rock, there wasn't any place that life could have evolved there. It was just too hot. Once the Earth cooled down, though, it seems that life evolved fairly quickly, maybe in a billion years or so. We start to see one-celled organisms kind of floating around or on rocks or things, which is kind of amazing when you think about it, that there was nothing and then that there was something, even these very pretty simple organisms. After that, from our point of view, it seems like evolution stalled a little bit. There was things going on at the time, but for the next few billion years or so, you basically just had more one-celled organisms, and, they were changing on some level, but they weren't the kind of things that we think about as life today, these large multicellular creatures. And a few things actually had to happen before we could get the kind of life that we have today. One important step along that way was that we had to develop mitochondria. Those are the things inside you that really give you power. They produce power for your cells. And the way we got mitochondria is kind of an interesting story, because long ago, our cells, whatever our ancestor was, it probably swallowed or got invaded by a very small one-celled creature, and they ended up kind of colonizing this little tiny creature inside it, in the sense that the creature, it might have tried to invade us, or it might have fought off being digested by the larger cell. And eventually, they kind of had a standoff where they each benefited each other by taking on new roles, new traits. The larger cell decided it would provide nutrients and protection. The little cell became specialized in producing power. And actually, if you look at our mitochondria today, they still have their own genes, their own DNA inside them. It's kind of a remnant of the time when they used to be independent creatures. So that was one of the really important steps along the way, was getting this new organelle inside us to create power. And there were other steps, too, like cells being able to communicate with each other or stick together or work together, or even the idea that we can turn cells on and off. So we can have specialized brain cells and skin cells and things like that. There were just a lot of different genetic changes that had to take place in order to give rise to the life we have today.
And there are certain similarities among all, say, let's say, animal life forms that have to do with our shared genetic heritage?
Yeah, there are certain genes that we share actually with all creatures, even bacteria we might share some genes with. And when you look at animals specifically, there's a very important set of genes called the Hox genes that give all animals their basic body plan. And that's why all animals kind of look the same. We all have kind of a cylindrical trunk with a head at one end and a rear end at the other end, and we have appendages sprouting off in between. And the reason why we all look kind of the same is we have these Hox genes, and they're the genes that build our bodies. They kind of lay out the blueprint for building our heads and our necks and all the way down to our toes. So that's why we all look alike, is we have this shared set of genes. It's part of our common genetic heritage.
And so when there's a mutation that changes something about a particular animal species or organism, that one is expressed in future generations as time goes by, but the original gene that caused a different thing isn't necessarily gone. It's just shut off. Is that right?
Yeah, there are times when genes do get turned on and off inside us. And as you said, the gene doesn't disappear, but it might not be able to do what it originally did. And that's, again, one of the things that the environment can do, is turn genes on and off inside you. It's, for instance, how identical twins come to be different, is they have identical DNA, but they don't have necessarily their genes working exactly the same because, again, you can turn them off, turn them on, turn the volume up or down. And that's how they come to look a little different and even have different personalities.
And, of course, they have different life experiences that contribute even further to that. They might eat a different diet. So you're not born and die on the same day, typically, as your identical twin.
No, you don't, because, again, genes really deal in probabilities. They don't deal in certainties. So you can look at your genes and figure out some things about you, but you certainly can't go into there and read it like kind of a biological horoscope or something like that. Genes just don't work that way.
Why was it such a big deal for Watson and Crick to figure out the structure of DNA?
It was a big deal because it really showed how DNA can replicate itself. That was one of the big questions was, well, if we know that there are these blueprints inside us, how does a cell know how to copy those blueprints and give it to the next generation? And Watson and Crick figured out with their double helix how this happens. What basically happens is there are four letters, so to speak, in the DNA alphabet when it's writing information down. There's A, there's C, there's G, and there's T. And if you have one strand of DNA and an A appears on it, a T always appears on the opposite strand. The A and the T always have to be together. Same with the C and a G. They always have to be together. So if you know what one side of a DNA strand says, you can read off or you can infer what the other side must say. And that's exactly what our cells do, is they look at one side and they can copy it and make an exact copy of the DNA. So it's a copying mechanism, really.
So knowing that we have all of these genes is one thing. Knowing specifically what they do and how they function is quite another. Talk a little bit about what it took specifically to map the human genome. This was a very fierce competition.
It was indeed. The Human Genome Project actually got started in the 1990s. It was kind of rumbling along for a while when a man named Craig Venter came, very controversial scientist, and there's a lot of scientists out there still very bitter and still write me angry letters about Craig Venter. Because what he did is he came along and he said, okay, the Human Genome Project is going to take 15 or so years and about $3 billion. I think I can do it in 4 years for $300 million, so for a tenth of the price. And he really threw a gauntlet at the government consortium that was working on the human genome, and he kind of forced them to change what they were doing. And there's a lot of scientists who think of Ventnor as kind of a hero. They like what he did. They liked how he introduced very quick, fast genetic sequencing. But there's, again, as I said, a lot of scientists still who think that Ventnor was kind of self-aggrandizing, that he took shortcuts. And I think you can really find out a lot about a person, a biologist, if you ask them who they admire more, the government team or Ventnor. I think that will give you an insight into their personality, definitely.
And what exactly does it mean to say we have mapped the human genome, and why was that such a time-consuming process before it was automated?
It means a couple of things. Mapping refers to figuring out where exactly each gene is. So we have 23 chromosomes. All of them have genes on them. But the gene that helps control your hair color might be on one chromosome, and a gene that helps control eye color might be on a different chromosome. They're just spread out on different chromosomes. So first of all, we need to figure out where the genes are. The other thing we need to do is called sequencing genes. And what that does is it looks at the individual letters, the A, the C, the T, and the G, and it finds the order of them. It's exactly like going into a book and reading what's there. You copy down the letters, and based on that information, you can hopefully figure out what the genes do. And it was such a long, hard process because there are 3 billion letters inside the human genome. Your average hardcover book might have, half a million letters. So you're talking about thousands of times longer than an average hardcover book and having to try to figure out what every single letter inside there is. So that's why it took such a long time.
So the human genome is very, very complicated. But as it turns out, one human to the next is far more similar than a lot of other animal species on the planet. And there's a really interesting reason for that.
Yeah, if you look at human genetic diversity, we actually have a lot less diversity than most other creatures that live, despite our very high population numbers. And the reason why is because it's almost certain that human beings were kind of pushed to the brink of extinction at a few points in our history. Some scientists think that there were as few as a few thousand adults. That's it. On the entire world. They were in Africa at the time, but it wasn't like we had one big group in a little village or something. They were probably scattered in small pockets in different parts of Africa. And to just think about there only being a few thousand adults, that's kind of the numbers you think about endangered species being at. That's kind of a critical level. So at one point in our history, we were like the pandas or the condors of Africa. And the reason we have such small genetic diversity today, even today, is because our population numbers did get pressed down pretty far in the past.
Why did we get such bigger and more functional brains than, at least as far as we can tell currently, than other animals have?
There are actually a lot of different things that contributed to it. It wasn't like we just got one magical gene turned on and we suddenly got bigger brains. There were a lot of different things that helped make our brains bigger and help certain parts get bigger. Even things like changing the shape of our skull to allow a little more room for the brain to expand into. So it was really a suite of genetic changes that came about at different points in our history, and each one of them kind of gave us a little bit of a brain boost. And eventually, there was sort of this runaway effect where once you got a few of these genes, you had a big advantage, and you could spread those genes much more quickly than people who lacked them.
Of course, those fantastic, highly functional brains are terrific, but they are also more vulnerable to disease, to problems, than less robust brains might be.
Yeah, they are. They're really more, they're more fragile in some ways because all the genes that contribute to, say, giving you a big brain, if one of those genes gets mutated, you can easily end up with a brain that suffers very quickly. And there are a number of genetic diseases out there and mutations that will cause problems to the brain. And that's one of the reasons why there's such a variety of mental problems and psychiatric problems is that even though we do have a genetic endowment to have a nice big brain, if something goes slightly wrong, or even just as likely, if genes that don't work so well together end up inside the same person, the brain can easily have something wrong with it as well.
So other animals might have an appreciation for aesthetic beauty, but as far as we can tell, we're the only ones who create symbolic art. Talk about what our genes have to do with that.
Yeah, a lot of scientists think, well, when you go down deep and fundamental into it, that there's a strong link between symbolic art and language, because symbolic art is always about something standing for something else. A painting on a cave wall isn't just a realistic depiction of what you might have seen. It usually had a ritualistic purpose. It stood for something else. And language is tied very, very closely to that. So in the book, I discuss kind of the origins of language and some different kind of surprising mutations that, you know, might have helped make us articulate, or it might have given us the jaw or mouth structure to be able to speak. And one actually big surprise is that it seems that Neanderthals had one of these mutations that we humans need in order to have articulate jaws and tongues. So it's possible that Neanderthals might have had some ability to articulate themselves.
My guest is science writer Sam Keen. We're talking this hour about his new book, The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author Sam Keen is with us this hour. His new book is called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sam, what is junk DNA and how have we come to understand that it matters more than its name might imply?
If you look at the DNA inside us, the DNA that makes genes, makes proteins, what we normally think about when we talk about genetics, that actually only makes up about 2% of all of our DNA. All of the rest of it kind of gets lumped together sometimes as junk DNA. Some of the DNA is, as far as we can tell, it is actually junk. For instance, about 8% of our DNA is actually old, broken down virus DNA that got inserted into us long ago and then never got cleaned out. So, you know, by that measure, at least, we're four times more virus than we are human. But all of the rest of that DNA, again, some of it's junk, but a lot of it, we think it probably has some sort of regulatory function. It helps turn genes on and off, or it has other roles that we don't quite know yet. So it was kind of a sneer when scientists said this is just junk DNA, but it really is a misnomer nowadays. And most scientists would call it something like non-coding DNA. And that's really one of the exciting areas of research, is to try to figure out what this supposed junk DNA is actually doing inside us.
The notion that genes get turned on and off at different times throughout our lifespans, I think people are aware of that. How does that play into the development of problems like cancers that may have to do with something in our genes and may have to do with our genes being damaged by some kind of external force?
Yeah, mutations can turn genes on and off. They can disable them, or they can prevent them from turning on, or various other things. The reason why we have different types of cells, skin cells, liver cells, and so on, they all have the same DNA, but they just have different genes turned on. And as you said, cancer is actually fundamentally a DNA disease. It has to do with certain genes getting turned off. The role of these genes is to stop cells from growing or proliferating at an unsustainable rate. And when these genes do get turned off, the cells can kind of grow uncontrollably, and that's what leads to what we call cancer.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting topic. I'm glad you guys just got on to the point of cancer. I've got a genetic condition called neurofibromatosis type 2, which from what I know is a mutation on chromosome 22, and it's hereditary, and it causes, a malfunction in the production of Merlin, which thus creates benign tumors along the nervous system, the brain, and the spine. And so what can we expect, from targeted gene therapies that can remediate these mutations?
Well, that is something scientists are actively working on. And I think one of the things we really learned from the Human Genome Project is that it's probably going to be turn out to be a little tougher than we imagine to translate genetic knowledge into medical knowledge for various reasons. But we are starting to get some insight into the basis for a lot of these diseases, and hopefully can start developing targeted therapies in the near future.
And we can learn in some cases by having our genetic profiles done. We can learn about susceptibility for certain diseases, but that is not, it's not a guarantee either way.
No, it's certainly not. So if you learn you have a susceptibility to something, there are things about your lifestyle or your diet or whatever that it can play into it and determine whether you do develop it. Or maybe you'll never get it no matter what, simply because of the way you other genes interact with it or suppress an incipient cancer or something like that. So again, genes really deal in probabilities. There's nothing certain about developing a disease.
Question here from Steve in Dallas via email. Is there any way for genes to change position in the DNA string over vast periods of time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Genes end up switching around places all the time. There's a section in the book, actually, where I talk about a process that basically makes what are called DNA palindromes. So like Madam, I'm Adam, or sex at noon taxes, these phrases that read the same forward and backward. And one of the ways that palindromes arise is when genes get flipped around, basically. They get copied out, so there's two copies, and then one of them gets flipped around. Or genes get switched around from one place to the other in a genome, from chromosome to chromosome. So yeah, there is a lot of activity, especially over the long term, millions of years, in where a gene will be in one species' DNA.
What do the scientists that you have spoken to think about the future of our natural evolution as humans now that we have taken some of this into our own hands and we have medicine to keep people alive and allow people to reproduce who wouldn't have been able to do so naturally?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, we've sort of exposed ourselves now to diseases that our ancestors probably wouldn't have gotten. A lot of people, because they would have died young long ago, it was probably very rare to have something like Alzheimer's disease, or certain forms of cancer that you only might get later in life. So by extending our lifespan on the one hand, we might have exposed ourselves to new diseases on the other hand. The other thing is that genes are really working with human culture nowadays. Hmm. So when you're talking about human evolution, you're really talking about human and human culture and our genes working together. It's sort of a co-evolution. One example of that is lactose tolerance. Lactose tolerance was introduced, and it actually got widespread because of people domesticating animals and having a ready source of milk nearby. So that's an example of something. It's a genetic change, but it never would have spread had we not had this cultural change that allowed it to spread. So again, it's gene culture co-evolution. And there's a lot of scientists trying to figure out how exactly those processes work.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Luke on the line next in Dallas. Hey, Luke.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. And Chris, thank you for taking the time to educate the public on this very interesting topic.
My pleasure.
Two questions, if I may. The first being, to what extent has the science of epigenetics become more valid, and to what extent can we see changes within 1 to 2 generations that epigenetics speaks to? And also, to backtrack a second, we talked about the concentrated human population in Africa, you know, many years back, and I've read articles that spoke to the increased fish in our diet had actually led to the brain size increasing by, you know, 300 milligrams or 3,000 milligrams at the time. I'm wondering if there's any validity to that.
Thanks so much for your call.
So I haven't read the article specifically about us getting a brain boost from fish, but it could be something, if this is true, where it's our genes working together with our environment, and maybe we sort of had this latent ability inside us to grow big brains, but we needed something like the oils in fish to really bring those traits out. So I haven't heard anything about this, but you know, it could be there could be something plausible going on there. About epigenetics specifically, that's what I was talking about a little earlier before, about turning genes on and off or turning the volume up and down on genes. And I do dedicate a chapter in The Violinist's Thumb to epigenetics and really to some of the stories behind epigenetics. That's really what the book emphasized throughout, was all of these different historical stories. And epigenetics has some really great and interesting stories behind it. So, yep, there's a chapter in the book about that. And it is a valid, very interesting field, a lot of scientists working in it.
And epigenetics, just so that we make sure at least I understand, is the idea that one's genes can change over the course of a lifetime, but those changes could actually be passed on to offspring. Is that correct?
Yeah. If you think about a mutation actually changes your DNA. An epigenetic change, it just maybe mutes the gene, or it prevents it from turning on. So the underlying DNA stays the same, but the DNA just isn't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these epigenetic traits, it seems they can get passed down from a parent to a child. So your environment or your diet might change you epigenetically. And in some cases, you can pass those changes down to your children. It remains to be seen how much of a long-term effect those epigenetic changes will have. But again, there's indications that what you eat or do could get passed down to your child, even though it doesn't change the DNA itself.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Joan on the line next in Dallas. Hello, Joan.
Hi. I think I'm getting really confused the more I listen to this. Sorry about that. But the difference between genes and DNA, I mean, I look at this is that I've had two different types of cancer, but that didn't surprise me because on my mother's side of the family, you could name probably any type of cancer, and somewhere someone on her side of the family has had it. So is that something that has come down through our DNA or has been passed genetically, or how do I describe that, or do I?
Well, it certainly could be something in the genetic background of your family. There are certain genes that whose job basically is to try to repair DNA damage, try to fix mutations so that cancer can't get a foothold or get going in the future. So with the caveat that, you know, you would need to look more specifically at your own DNA and the DNA of your family, there are certainly genes that could kind of have this general effect and could lead to higher rates of cancer.
What sort of choices might we be able to make in the future based on our understanding of DNA about the kinds of offspring we give birth to?
Well, we can already do some good genetic testing nowadays to make sure that we don't have genetic disorders. Mm-hmm. There, you can go to genetic counseling and try to figure out if you have a susceptibility to, you know, cystic fibrosis or something like that. So we can do a better job of trying to prevent these diseases from arising that cause a lot of human heartache. In the future, it's even plausible, I don't know how probable, but it's at least possible, that we could take a more active role. I'm a little doubtful we'll be able to do something very dramatic, like make these super babies with all of these amazing abilities. But, you know, it's possible we could end up changing superficial traits like eye color or something like that. And in fact, there are scientists already working on using viruses, basically, to kind of introduce new DNA into people to try to correct sometimes these inborn errors, these genetic malfunctions that people have. The viruses can go in there, introduce new DNA that can sometimes correct them. So I'm certain our DNA will continue to change in the future.
Of course, as the title of your book would suggest, we don't always necessarily know whether certain things will be good or bad with regard to the genes that we've been given.
Yeah, the title of the book refers to Niccolo Paganini, who's usually considered the greatest violinist who ever lived, playing for kings and emperors, Napoleon in Europe. And there are always rumors he sold his soul to Satan for his talents. That's how good he was. And he had these really amazingly flexible hands and fingers. That's one of the reasons he was so good, was he had hands that he could stretch incredibly wide, and fingers he could put in all sorts of unusual positions on the violin. And in retrospect, it's almost certain that he had a genetic disorder of some sort, and that's why his hands were so flexible. And I like it for the title of the book because it shows how your genes and environment work together. Paganini was a very hard worker, also had a lot of passion for music. So it was this temperament coming together in someone who had a genetic endowment to really take advantage of it. It was kind of a perfect storm of things coming together. But as you alluded to, while his genes helped make him on the one hand, his genes ended up almost unmaking him in another way, because the same thing that gave him such flexible hands also ended up introducing a lot of other genetic problems. And by the end of his life, he was actually very ill, and he ended up dying very young.
Have to jump in there.
Medical problem.
Sadly, the new book by author Sam Keen is called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. Sam, fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can get the podcast every day for free online at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.